Every city has its Tenderloin. It's the part of town where you can feel the air change as you break through some invisible epidermis of squalor. A down-at-the-heels, joyless place where a city has gone wrong and can't figure out a way to right itself. Though the Tenderloin is in the heart of the city, it seems like a bad piece of fruit, left too long in the sun and attracting the attention of flies and hornets. Although the Tenderloin was once lovely, and much of its architecture is still a pleasure to behold, it has spent itself with all the intrigues required by dissipation. In San Francisco, you know that you are entering a rough neighborhood because no room has a view. In the Tenderloin, all vistas are worthless and disheartening. All alleyways smell of urine, strewn garbage, and cheap wine. On Monday, we are to deliver meals to 7 hotels, more than 100 meals. Our plan is to stick together and work with the utmost speed as we enter the Hotel Cortez. Sheba pacifies the deskman as the rest of us spread out through a hotel that does justice to the word flea bag. It smells of the kind of mold that grows on expensive cheeses, but also of a darker variety that has metastasized in dampness and air shafts and crawl spaces, untouched by disinfectants. With 6 boxes of lunches, I sprint up a flight of steps that seems in danger of collapsing beneath my weight. Molly brings up the rear, with Niles and Fraser matching her step for step. I knock at the first door and hear a faint stirring, but the movements seem overcautious. A weakened voice finally asks, "Open hand?" I call, "Lunch is served." The man laughs as he unlocks the door. Thus, I make my first acquaintance with a human skeleton so ravaged by AIDS, I do not think he will see the next sunrise. "Are you Jeff McNaughton?" I place his food on an unpainted desk. He looks translucent in his thinness, and I watch blood flowing through the veins in his forehead. His flesh looks like it is made of onion skin.
"I ordered beluga caviar with blinis. Also a bottle of iced Finlandia to wash it down. I do hope there were no mix-ups," he says.
"I can't lie to you, Jeff. Someone substituted savruga at the last minute. It was an outrage, but I'm just a delivery boy. My name's Leo King. You'll be seeing me for the next couple of weeks." The man begins a spasm of coughing.
"I won't last a week, Leo. I've got the pneumocystis pneumonia. It's come back to me."
"You need me to call anyone?" I ask. "Your parents? Your family?"
"All the calls have been made," he says. "None of them answered."
"I'm looking for a friend." I pull out a circular. "His name is Trevor Poe. You know him?"
"The piano player."
Jeff studies the photograph.
"I used to see him play in bars in the Castro, but we were never formally introduced."
"If you hear where he is, will you call me?" I ask. "You can reach me at the number below his picture."
"No phones at the Cortez," Jeff tells me.
I help him over to the desk and open his lunch for him.
"I won't be leaving this room, Leo. And you're the only name on my dance card, sweetheart. Thanks for lunch."
On the next door, I knock loudly, and it is answered by an older man who is in much better physical condition than his younger companion. Rex Langford is the older man, and Barry Palumbo the younger. Barry's eyes are open, but offer no sign of greeting. He could have been a mannequin if I could not hear his raspy breathing.
"You're early. Unprecedented," Rex says.
"First day. At the rate I'm going, I'll get lunch to some of these guys by midnight."
"New on the block, huh?" he asks. "Somebody at open hand hates your guts. No one lasts long delivering meals to the Cortez."
"My name's Leo. Anything I can do for y'all?"
"Y'all. Music to my ears. A concerto at last. A country cousin come to town."
"Where are you from?"
"Ozark, Alabama," he tells me. "It's not far from Enterprise, which boasts a sculpture of a boll weevil on its main drag."
You're joking, right?
Sadly, I'm reporting the gospel truth. The Louvre has its Venus de Milo, but Enterprise, Alabama, has its boll weevil. Both represent something essential about the souls of each place. It must be odd growing up in Ozark, Alabama, I say. Growing up is odd no matter where you do it. That's my only piece of observed wisdom. It's yours for free, he says. I like it. I accept it as a gift. Where are you from, Cracker Boy? Do I detect the slight memory flaring of Mobile in that accent?
Charleston, South Carolina. There's a Huguenot influence in both accents. I place a circular in his hands. I'm looking for a friend. Trevor Poe's his name. You ever run across him?
Did he go to the baths? Rex asks.
Trevor lived at the baths.
Then our lives may have abutted, Rex says, if you get my drift.
If you have any friends who visit, would you ask them about Trevor Poe?
Most of my friends are dead, except Barry over there. Say hello to Leo, Barry. He brought us lunch. Isn't that nice?
Hello, Leo.
His voice sounds half-human. Barry's blind, Rex says. I feed him. And he throws up. Then I feed him again, and he throws that up too.
I can't help it, Rex,
Barry whispers. It's nice of you to do for him, Rex, I say.
Not nice at all. It's all I've got to do, he says with a shrug. He'll go, then I'll go. But there won't be anyone to help me.
Do you have any money, Rex? I ask.
Of course not. Both Barry and I get welfare checks, but that goes poof into the wind. Medicine, rent for this penthouse, and so forth.
From the bed, Barry calls out,
Will the guy who brought lunch call my sister Lonnie?
I'll be glad to call Lonnie, I tell him.
We were so close when we were growing up. No sister ever loved a brother like Lonnie loved me.
I'll call her tonight, Barry.
Her husband hates me, so hang up if he answers the phone. I'd love to have her visit me one last time. Give him her number, Rex.
Rex writes on a piece of paper and hands it to me as I exit. I walk down the hall toward my next delivery and open the paper. Don't bother, it reads in a barely legible scrawl. She says it's God's will he's dying, calls it a pervert's death, but thanks anyway.
Each day we return to our elegant quarters on Vallejo Street, spent and defeated. We follow up leads that come in by the hundreds based on Herb Kahn's column. We received 3 letters from men who claimed to be Trevor Poe, as well as 5 ransom notes from people claiming to be holding him hostage. I speak to kooks, weirdos, 5 private detectives, dozens of Trevor's former lovers, his masseuse, his barber, his neighborhood grocer, and 3 psychics who promise to discover his whereabouts. At the first week's end, we gather on Saturday evening for a serious conference. We have been efficient, yet we all agree that we are no closer to finding Trevor than we were before leaving our jobs and homes in Charleston. We vow not to give up yet, but to dedicate ourselves to one more week. We go to bed exhausted and praying for a break. The next day, I am not expecting what I find in room 487 at the end of still another lightless hallway in the Devonshire Hotel. I notice that none of those hotels give much room for hope to hide in, and the Devonshire is worse than most. I know something is wrong as soon as I knock on the door of room 487. I am greeted by a silence that unnerves me, with no stirring or rustling about or shuffling of unsteady, slippered feet. I try the doorknob and it comes off in my hand, but the door swings open on rusted hinges. Inside, a young boy is sleeping, his blonde curls and full lips giving him the look of a figurine trapped in an unnatural stillness.
He cannot be more than 20 years old, but his attractiveness is offset by the smell of excrement that seeps through his silk pajamas and the cheap sheets that cover him. I place his food on a dresser, then touch my hand to his forehead. When my hand feels the coldness, I know he has been dead for hours. The peaceful expression on his face is an act of mercy that death can sometimes bestow on someone in unbearable pain. His clothes hang neatly in a filthy, mouse-befouled closet, and I find his wallet in the back pocket of his best suit. His driver's license contains a picture of him smiling with some coyness and impish humor. His name is Aaron Satterfield, and he once lived in an apartment on Sacramento Street. Inside his wallet, I discover several photographs of interest. There is a series of photos of Aaron and four of his friends dressed as cowboys at a Halloween party in the Castro. The same group of five mug for a camera in one of those lamentable curtained booths you find in cheap bus stations. On the back of the photo, Aaron has written these words: "All dead except me." In the top drawer of his bedside table, I find two letters, one from his mother and one from his father. Because I am present at their son's deathbed and they are not, I feel I have a right to read those letters. A part of me has to know the story of why this gorgeous child died alone. It is the Satterfield family of Stewart, Nebraska, who should be standing over the body of this blonde, wasted boy, and not me. As that thought preys on me, I wonder how long the tears have been running down my face, and if they are tears of pity or rage or a molten combination of both at the same time. The father's letter could not have been pithier or more to the point. "Faggot, if you are dying as you claim, I declare it God's will. That you have been something foul and unclean in the eyes of God is no surprise. It is Bible written and Bible promised. I would not send you a penny I made from working on my farm. May God have mercy on your soul. I have none. Your father, Olin Satterfield." After I finish the father's letter, I sit there trembling and tearful while I pray to God and ask him not to allow me ever to think like the people of God if it requires me to be anything like Olin Satterfield. No matter what your scriptures say, Lord, I will not do it. I open his mother's letter and read, "Dearest Aaron, this $100 is the last of the nest egg I have saved since the day I married your father. I don't know what he would do if he found out I'd been sending you money all this time. I wish I could be beside you right now, taking care of you, cleaning up for you, making sure you were eating right, holding you and telling you stories you used to love as a child. I kiss you now, and it carries all my love and all the hurt I feel for you. By the power of prayer, I believe that Jesus will cure you. He died on the cross for people like you and me, and especially for people like your father. Your father loves you as much as I do, but his stubbornness won't let him feel it. At night, he wakes up crying, and it has nothing to do with the wheat or the cows. I love you as much as Jesus does. Mom." The death of this pretty half-child proves to me that I have come to one hotel too many in this beleaguered city. If I wished to spend my life working miracles among the dead and the dying, I could have gone to medical school. But I was born to write frivolous, witty columns about the pulse rate of Charleston. My time among young men dying of starvation because of some ruthless virus loose in their bloodstream is starting to wear me out. I want out of San Francisco, and the sooner the better. At this moment, I don't give a damn whether we find Trevor Poe or not. I want to sleep in my own bed, and work in my own garden, and walk down streets where every house is familiar to me. Mostly, I want to run away from the presence of this dead Nebraska boy, and yet I sit beside him on his bed, staring at his lovely, inanimate face.
Then I smell his shit again and spring into an action that surprises me. I remove his sheets and pajama bottoms and clean him up with a towel I find in his sink. Gathering the towel and the sheets and the pajama bottoms together, I open up a window and hurl the fetid pile into the alley below. I find some Paco Rabanne aftershave lotion in his shaving kit, and after I shave him, I liberally sprinkle him from his cheeks to his thighs with the sweet-smelling cologne. Carefully, I comb his hair and style it the way I found it in his wallet photograph. I cover him with a blanket he had kicked off the bed, and I feel a certain satisfaction when I have completed my assignment. To me, Aaron Satterfield is ready for anything, a baptism, a laying on of hands, or a meeting with the Godhead. When I finish, I burst into tears, and of course, that is when Molly Rutledge finds me.
"We've been looking all over for you," she says,
then realizes the situation. She goes over and touches Aaron's face with remarkable tenderness and says,
"Oh my God, what a beautiful boy."
I hand her the two letters and she reads them without emotion or commentary.
"He looks as though he died while dreaming something nice, Leo," she says afterward.
"Yeah, I had the same sickly sentimental thought when I first saw him, too."
"I guess what I mean is that I'm glad his suffering is over," Molly says, choosing not to react to my acidulous tone.
My weeping embarrasses me, and I wish I could have finished it before she entered the room.
"We'll have to call the police," Molly says. "They'll take him to the morgue. We can let his parents know tonight."
"Why weren't they here?" I ask. "Or why didn't they bring him home?"
"Shame.
Pure human shame on his father's part. Fear of the father on the mother's. I bet the father tormented this poor kid from the time he was born.
Come on, Leo. We'll do your last floor together. They're waiting for us. If we were all as slow as you, these boys in the Tenderloin would starve to death."
Molly takes my list and adds,
"Just 3 more rooms and we're through for the day."
She touches Aaron's face again with her soft, manicured hand.
"What have we gotten ourselves into, Leo?
This time out here will change us forever.
It'll mark us in ways we don't know.
Was it hard downstairs in this dump?"
"It was awful.
We're not going to find any nice death by AIDS. It's like all of them, every one of them, have been nailed to their beds." "We're not going to find Trevor, are we?" I say. "We're just putting on a show to make ourselves feel better. Make Sheba feel better." Molly wipes the tears from my face with a handkerchief.
"Remember who we are, Leo. We're folks who get things done.
We're going to find Trevor and take him home with us. We might lose him in the end, but he's going to be surrounded by people who love his ass when he dies. We aren't going to let him die like Aaron Satterfield. Get the picture?"
"Yeah, girl. I get the picture."
And Molly licks the last tears that roll down my cheek. I try to regain control of the situation, that terrible moment of time.
"Why did you do that?" "Because I wanted to. It tasted good, like an oyster, or a pearl from an oyster. Salty like the ocean off Sullivan's Island." "I liked it that you cleaned this boy up," she said.
"How did you know I cleaned him up?"
"Ike and Betty were standing near the alley when you threw all the stuff out the window. Then Betty ran up to tell me you needed some help. Ike gathered up all the stuff and put it in the dumpster. Said it smelled like hell."
"Why didn't Betty come find me?"
"She thought I could handle it," Molly says. "Plus, Betty's calling the cops. An ambulance is on the way. Let's finish and get out of here."
"Good idea. Sorry I took so long."
"You're forgiven, Toad," she says, smiling. "Just this once."
That evening, I pick up the phone in the small office off the kitchen and dial for information in Stewart, Nebraska, where I ask for the number of Olin Satterfield. With the compassionate telepathy that made her famous among her friends, Molly Rutledge enters the room behind me, carrying tumblers with two fingers of Jack Daniels on the rocks. The phone rings twice, and the father answers. "Mr. Satterfield," I say. "This is Leo King calling from San Francisco. I'm calling with news of your son." "There must be some mistake," he says. "I have no son." "Aaron Satterfield is not your son?" "Do you speak English? I just told you that I don't have a son." "Do you have a wife named Clea Satterfield?" I ask, studying the name on the second letter I hold in my hand. "I may, and I may not," he replies. With some effort, I control my temper and say, "If Clea Satterfield has a son, sir, I would like to talk to her." "Clea Satterfield is my wife." The man's voice is glacial. "And I assure you that neither of us has a son." A brief but furious argument breaks out on the plains of Nebraska, in a state where I have never set foot, and it is muffled yet hard fought. Then I hear the voice of a woman, clearly agitated and at the end of whatever short rope she is tethered to in the small acreage of her life. "This is Clea Satterfield," she says. "I'm Aaron's mother." "I'm afraid I've got some terrible news for you, ma'am," I say. "Aaron died today in a hotel in San Francisco." I would have continued, but I hear a scream of purest sorrow, and for several seconds her voice is something primal and ancient and inhuman. "There must be some mistake," she says, between terrible sobs. "Aaron's always been a healthy boy." "Aaron died of AIDS, Mrs. Satterfield," I say. "He was probably too embarrassed to tell anyone." "You mean cancer," she corrects me. "Aaron died of cancer, you say?" "They said it was AIDS. I'm no doctor, but he was diagnosed with AIDS." "Cancer is such a killer," she says. "I don't know a family in our community it hasn't touched. It's such a scourge. Did Aaron say anything before he died? I didn't get your name." "Leo King," I answer. "Yes, he said to tell his parents that he loved both of you very much. Both of you. His mama and his daddy." "Such a sweet boy," she says. "Always thinking of others. Where is he now? His remains, I mean." "In the city morgue. Here's the name of a funeral home that you can call and they'll prepare the body to ship home for burial." I give her the name and number of a funeral home that specializes in the preparation of corpses who died of AIDS. "Wasn't my boy beautiful?" Mrs. Satterfield asks. "One of the best-looking men I ever saw," I say. "Even the cancer couldn't touch that." I hear something strange in the background and ask, "What's that?" "That's my husband, Nolan, Aaron's father. He's crying, so I have to go." "You sure Aaron told you he loved me and his father very much, Mr. King?" "Those were his last words," I lie. "Goodbye, Mrs. Satterfield. I'm Roman Catholic, and I'll have a mass said in memory of your son."
"We're Pentecostal. Please, no masses for us," she says. "Let us do the praying. Let us do the burying. We'll do it the old way and the right way. You wouldn't understand."
"Mrs. Satterfield," again my blood is up, "that should have been you and your husband with Aaron when he died, not me. That's the old way. That's the right way." She hangs up on me and I put my face in my hands. "I had no right to say that to that poor woman," I tell Molly.
"The hell you didn't," Molly says. "She's lucky it wasn't me who called her. I'd have told her exactly what I thought of her and her god-awful husband."
"He was pretty torn up."
"It's easy to be torn up in Nebraska," Molly says. "It's harder in room 487 in the Hotel Devonshire. Let's go feed the troops."
Just past midnight, my bedroom door opens. I reach up to turn on the lamp by my bed. Molly Rutledge enters, trailing her beauty like something that can damage a man or change his life forever. She is carrying two glasses, and I smell the Grand Marnier as she sets them on the table. She removes her robe to reveal a silken, diaphanous gown that makes me praise God for the shape of women. I do not like that Molly is putting us in such an awkward situation, but I don't hate her for it either. Even so, our friendship holds a richness and a power and a completeness that I do not wish to risk because her misguided husband has developed a taste for long-legged Brazilians half his age. While Molly's prettiness is classic, imperturbable, natural, I sport a face that has no business coming anywhere in the vicinity of hers. She is one of the great beauties of her Charleston generation, and I am just a foot soldier in society who knows his place in the order of things. Molly looks at me and takes a sip of her drink.
Well?
I can think of a thousand reasons not to do this, Molly.
That all you got?
Your sister-in-law is upstairs sleeping with my brother-in-law. It seems tacky to have a romp in the basement under those circumstances.
Seems natural to me, she says. What does a nice girl have to do to get laid around here?
We're both married. I'm the godfather of your daughter. I was a groomsman in your wedding.
Tell me that you don't love me and I'll leave.
I'm not in love with you, Molly. I've always had a thing for Trevor Poe.
I knew you'd make one of your stupid jokes. I was expecting it. Now I'm going to lie down beside you.
I'm afraid for you two, I say.
Why?
I'm up on my rabies shots. I'm afraid the world won't ever be the same.
I don't want the world to be the same.
She walks over to the bed and turns out the light. On this night, I rediscover why all the great religions condemn the sweet, enchanted crime of lust. When I am inside Molly's body, when the cells of my flesh light up in ecstasy with the fiery truth of her flesh, I feel the creation of a whole new world as we move together, purr together, moan together. My tongue becomes her tongue. Our lips burn in congruence. Our breasts lock into each other's heartbeats. When I come in a burst of fire and flood, she roars in behind me. Words pour out of me that I had thought for 20 years but had never believed I would whisper in the ears of this woman, and she accepts them with forbidden words of her own. With a cry, I fall off her. Then she kisses me a final time. In darkness, she gathers garments that are feathery, and in nakedness she leaves me. What began in mere sin ended in sacrament, and as I lie there alone, I know that she was right. My world will never be the same.
Chapter 16. The Patel Connection. When we finish our work for Open Hand on Tuesday, a police car is waiting for us, parked in front of the Vallejo Street house. Ike and Betty go over to flash their badges and speak with a detective. Rather than the break we are hoping for, it turns out to be a surprise. The police want to interrogate me about a murder for which I am a prime suspect. That's when I see Anna Cole walking toward me. The homicide detective is named Thomas Stearns McGraw, the son of two poetry-loving parents. His father teaches American literature at Berkeley, and his mother's father is a third cousin twice removed of the author of The Wasteland. Since it is a new experience for me to be a suspect in a murder case, I do not learn this fascinating autobiographical detail at our first encounter, but later, since Tom McGraw is a gifted conversationalist and a man with a curious nature. I introduce Anna Cole to everybody and explain who she is. Anna is obviously deeply shaken by the recent turn of events, and her hands tremble visibly. She turns to me in a sudden white fury and says, "I knew I shouldn't have opened the door for you."
Let's go inside to discuss this, Detective McGraw, Ike says. Tom McGraw's unexpected arrival breaks up the rhythm of habit that has sustained us in our search. Everyone wants to be present when the detective questions me. But Ike assumes control and sends the others to the phone bank in the dining room, ordering them to remember the hundreds of leads that need to be followed up. Sheba kisses me on the cheek. If Leo King committed murder, Detective, I'll jump off the Golden Gate Bridge and let you film my suicide. You'll have worldwide rights to my death.
How can you joke about something so horrible?
Anna Cole asks, then breaks down crying. Because none of us knows what this is about, I tell her. I've never murdered anyone, so at this moment I'm fairly relaxed.
Shouldn't we get Leo a lawyer?
Sheba asks Ike.
He doesn't need a lawyer, Ike says. He's never even gotten a parking ticket.
Anna Cole is completely unstrung, and we have to wait for her hysteria to ease before the interrogation can begin.
Ma'am, could I get you a glass of water? Ike asks softly. We could get this done a lot faster if you could get control of yourself.
Anna says, through tears,
All I did was send the cops a photocopy of the man who was stalking me like you told me to do, Leo.
He was from San Rafael, right? I ask. I forget his name. Detective McGraw helps me out. His name was John Summey. He lived at 25710 Vendola Drive in San Rafael. He worked as a physical therapist at a retirement center here in the city.
And he had picked up a bad habit of stalking young women from Minnesota, I add.
That's what Miss Cole said, the detective says. But a problem came up.
What's the problem? Ike asks.
John Summey turned up dead in the trunk of his car in a city parking lot day before yesterday. The back of his head was caved in by a blunt instrument. There was some noticeable decomposition of the body. In other words, a bad odor led to someone making a complaint. It took us a day to run the tag number. We interviewed the distraught Mrs. Summey, who filed a missing person report last week. Then voila, Anna Cole's complaint comes up. We visit, and she gives us your name, Leo King, as the last person who saw Mr. Summey alive.
It's all because I opened the door for you, Anna screams. I've never opened the door to a stranger in my life, and then you stalk that man down and kill him?
Whoa, Ike says. Let's not jump too far ahead of things here.
Miss Cole said that you threatened the man with a gun, Detective McGraw says to me. It was Miss Cole's, a .22 revolver. You asked for it when you went over to confront Summey.
Anna seemed frightened by the guy, I explain. She had a pistol in her hand when I rang the doorbell. She told me about the man stalking her. I borrowed the gun in case I had to bluff him, which I did.
Miss Cole said you kicked in his window, the detective says. This was corroborated when we searched the car. Could you explain why?
He wouldn't roll down his window, and I wanted to get his attention. I also wanted to find out who he was.
So you threatened him with a gun?
Yes, I threatened him with a gun.
Leo, you dumb, dumbass white boy, Ike sighs.
Then you stole his wallet and his sunglasses?
I confiscated his wallet, hoping that he would leave Miss Cole alone, I say.
You succeeded, Mr. McGraw says. And the last time he was seen alive, you were aiming a gun at his face.
Yes, I was, but Mr. Summey was seen by me and Miss Cole racing up Union Street at a high speed, very much alive.
Actually, we think that Mr. Summey might have been dead at that particular moment in time, Mr. King, the detective says. According to our timeline, Mr. Summey may have already been killed and stuffed in that trunk. Could you give a description of the man driving that car?
White man, 6 feet tall, black hair, I say.
Could the hair have been dyed?
I don't know. I'm not a hair colorist, I say.
It was a wig, a toupee, a cheap one.
Don't be smart-mouthed, Toad, Ike says sharply. The man deserves serious answers.
I'm sorry, Detective McGraw, I say. I didn't get a good look at the man.
How old would you say he was?
He looked like an older man trying to pretend he was much younger. He had deep brown eyes, bushy eyebrows. He was a powerfully built man, but he had seen better days.
Mr. Summey was born in New Delhi, India.
He was on a student visa when he married Isabel Summey. He changed his name legally from Patel to Summey to sound more American. He was 5'7" tall and weighed 140 pounds.
Not the same guy I met, I say emphatically.
The driver's license has been doctored. We think that photo is the murderer. He passes me a copy of the license, and I study the photograph. I gave only a cursory glance during the incident on Union Street. I can't tell if it's the same guy or not. I just got a brief look at him, then sent him on his way. Detective McGraw hands me another picture, this one of a small-boned Indian man. That's a recent photograph of Mr. John Summey, formerly Anjit Patel. Not the guy driving the car, I say. Not even close. How long ago did you notice the man following you, Miss Cole? Asks Detective McGraw.
2 days. He followed me to work on Thursday. I noticed him while I was waiting for the bus. Then I was shocked to see him when I got off near my office in the financial district. He was waiting when I got back home. Then the same thing on Friday. He would leave for the night, but was there when I woke up the next morning. Just parked, waiting. I'd called the cops and reported it on Friday. Then Leo rang the doorbell the next day.
But he never approached you or threatened you? The detective asks. Am I correct in assuming he never spoke to you or accosted you? Could he have been following someone else from your neighborhood?
He was staring at me. I was the one he was after,
Anna says, trembling with conviction. I tell the detective, when I went out to take down his license plate number and tried to confront him, he lay down on the floorboards. Unless he spilled some peanuts, it sure looked like he was hiding from someone. Do you have a license for the pistol you used, Mr. King? The man asks. I borrowed the pistol from Miss Cole, I say.
It was a gift from my dad, Anna says. He didn't give me a license. I don't own any ammunition.
Could either of you pick this man out of a police lineup? Detective McGraw asks.
No,
Anna and I answer at the same time. If you see the man again, will you report it to me immediately? He hands us each a card and also gives one to Ike. Before he leaves, Detective McGraw asks me, Do you still have those sunglasses? I think I do. Let me run down and check. I toss them into a drawer on my bedside table. McGraw says, Let me go with you and may have a good set of this guy's fingerprints. In my catacomb of a bedroom, I turn on the light switch and am astonished to find my room torn apart. Before I can go on to assess the damage, Detective McGraw stops me with a hand squeezing my shoulder. He pushes me back outside my room, then enters the room with caution. He takes out his notebook and writes several things, then asks me, Is that the table where you put the sunglasses? The table is smashed and the drawers lying on the bed, which a knife has slashed clean through. In a mansion filled with Picassos, Monets, and Miros, overstocked with silver services and candelabra and movable antiques, priceless even on the black market, it is a surprise to find the most modest room in the house vandalized. He came to find those sunglasses, the detective says. How did he know you were staying at this house?
I don't have a clue.
Hell, the Herb Kahn article, maybe. I'm going to tape this door shut. I'll have the boys from the lab come out here tomorrow to take a look-see. I don't like this. I'm going to look in the bathroom. Does anyone use it but you?
No, sir.
My name is Tom. No need to call me sir. He takes out a handkerchief and pushes against the half-opened bathroom door. I can see the contents of my shaving kit strewn everywhere.
Could you come in here, Leo? Detective McGraw asks.
Please do not touch or disturb anything, but explain this to me if you can. It angers me to see the contents of every vial of medicine I own spread across the floor. The intruder has emptied my shaving cream into the sink and broken my bottle of aftershave lotion and squeezed out the last worming loop of my toothpaste. The bathroom mirror covering the medicine cabinet is open wide, and the fancy contents that the producer left for guests have been flung. But the disturbing nature of this visitation does not overwhelm me until McGraw shuts the mirror and I see the flyer notifying San Francisco of the disappearance of Trevor Poe. It is the drawing that freezes my cells in all the dread of memory and history. In the secret mythology that forms the grotesque substrata that lies at the center of this search that has just turned deadly.
Can we get police protection at this house? I ask. Starting tonight?
If there's a good reason, Detective McGraw says.
Could we get Sheba and Ike and Niles in here? I ask.
None of the other women, please.
Ike and Niles arrive first. I hear Sheba protesting as she is led by the arm by Tom McGraw.
What's up, Toad?
Niles asks.
Who the hell did this to your room? Ike adds.
I can hear Sheba at her most put upon as she enters. The violation of the bedroom shocks her, but she almost falls to her knees when she sees the fluttering piece of paper with her brother's photograph taped to the bathroom mirror. In bright red fingernail polish, someone has drawn the image of a smiley face. Sliding out of the left eye is a tear rolling down the featureless cheek.
Jesus Christ, Ike says.
Holy shit, Niles gasps. What does that mean?
I say, Sheba, your dad's still alive. He was the guy in the car. The following day, Ike takes command of our embattled unit, now exiled and afraid. By sunrise, there is a San Francisco cop patrolling the front of the house like a Praetorian guard. The intruder entered through the backyard fence, which the lifeless body of a poisoned Rottweiler proves. The police find no fingerprints, no hair follicles, and no evidence of forced entry. They discover a single footprint of a size 11 New Balance running shoe on the lower terrace. For 2 hours, they question Sheba and hear the details of a tumultuous family history that includes every essential piece of the puzzle we had all been trying to solve through the years. All of us had known something. None of us had known everything. I pour Sheba a cup of black coffee when she joins us for breakfast. Tension shimmers in the sunless, fog-bound air. It is cold in the city, which seems to have no real attachment to or belief in summertime. A disputatious silence grips all of us. It seems like a corporal act of mercy when Ike takes charge and draws up a plan.
Last night changes everything, Sheba, Ike says. You know that better than anybody.
I wouldn't put any of you in danger, Sheba tells us. I can only hope you believe that.
Molly is the most visibly shaken of all of us. She has not once mentioned our evening together, nor has she made any effort to speak privately to me, or so much as touch my hand. Her cool avoidance is difficult to understand, as Molly isn't a cold woman. She is caring, devoted, loving, and loyal. And it has only gradually dawned on me, these last few days in California, that she is also a compartmental kind of woman. She has a drawer for family, a drawer for friends, a drawer for house repairs, and a drawer for Leo, her faithful servant and devoted lover. I think her silence comes from the fact that she hasn't yet decided what to do with the Chad drawer. Throw it out? Reorganize? The uncertainty of it all seems to have paralyzed her, and the reappearance of Mr. Poe has only added to that feeling of creeping chaos. It is clear that her enthusiasm for the trip has considerably waned, and her voice is sharp when she tells Sheba,
"Coming out here to find Trevor was a lark. It was a pleasure. It gave us all a chance to prove something to one another, to have an adventure together. You didn't say a thing about our dying in the process." "I thought my old man was dead," Sheba says. "We've got kids to think about, Sheba," Fraser states it in her most matter-of-fact manner. "Then all of you get the fuck out of here and I'll find my goddamn brother by myself."
Sheba seems to scream it out of a despondency that comes from some dark place inside her.
"I'd like to suggest a plan of action," Ike says. "I think the risk is minimal. Betty and I worked this out last night."
Betty adds, "It's not perfect, but it's a plan."
Ike says. Let's give it till Sunday. That'll mean we've been out here for over 2 weeks. We've busted our asses. We put ads in the newspaper, circulars all over the city, got a column out of Herb Kahn. Sheba's been interviewed by every radio and television show in the city. All of the gay newspapers have covered why we're out here. We've given it our best shot.
I was with Fraser, ready to get on a flight this morning, Betty says. But Ike's plan seems better. He always keeps a cool head.
He's not a mother, Molly says. Neither is Sheba. And Leo is not a father. I'd rather OD on heroin than let Chad and that Brazilian twat raise my children.
Don't forget that Chad happens to be my brother, Fraser says. He loves those kids as much as you do.
We don't need a catfight, Niles says, trying to defuse the situation. We got problems enough.
I saw you sneaking up from the basement the other night, Fraser says to Molly. I was using the hall bathroom so I wouldn't wake Niles. I guess you and Leo were discussing the need for economic reform in Sri Lanka. I warmed up a cup of milk in the microwave.
Molly's lie lacks conviction.
I couldn't sleep. You smelled a lot like sex to me, Fraser says.
The whole room gasps. I have never known such words to come out of Fraser's mouth. If I had not heard them with my own ears, I wouldn't have believed it. By her expression, I can tell she has even shocked herself.
So the Rutledge family closes ranks, Molly says. Little Chad does whatever he wants, and Molly and the kids have to hold their tongues and smile for the camera while the house burns down.
Apologize to Molly, Niles says to Fraser, his blue eyes glittering.
I have nothing to apologize for, she replies. You'd have to be blind not to see what she and Leo are up to. And I didn't come out here to make orphans out of my kids.
What do you have against orphans? Niles asks his wife. Now the room seems to be spinning out of control, a molecular planet freed from its own minimalist laws of gravity.
Nothing at all, darling.
Fraser is gaining a measure of control over herself.
It's just not the fate I choose for our children,
no matter how character-building it might seem to you. I've never thought of it like that, Niles says. It was the most terrifying thing in the world. I woke up scared every day. I went to school scared, and so did my sister. It ruined her whole life. Your loving me saved my life, Fraser. My sister got hurt so bad that even Leo's love couldn't come close to touching her heart. So Leo ruined his life by loving someone who couldn't be fixed. But as scared as I was, and as scared as Starla was, I don't think that either of us were scared like Sheba and Trevor were. I didn't have much of a daddy, and that was a bad thing. But they had one who wanted to terrify them and hunt them down through the years. I don't know the whole story, Sheba, not by a long shot. But I know it's a bad story. A real bad story. Ike stands up, his voice peremptory yet calming.
Here's the plan that works for Betty and me. We promised Open Hand we'd deliver food to those hotels until Sunday. But we're changing the way we do things now. Betty and I won't be making deliveries. We'll play cops instead. We'll all move together, one hotel at a time. The San Francisco cops will guard this house day and night. We'll finish this job up and we'll do it right. Toad, will you fix dinner tonight?
Be happy to.
We'll eat all our meals inside with shades drawn and curtains pulled. No more swimming, no more hot tubs.
What about my honeymoon with Leo?
Molly asks.
Shut up, Molly, Ike commands.
I got scared, Fraser explains. I ran my mouth.
For the first time in your life, you sounded mean, Fraser. Niles says, staring at his wife, who refuses to encounter his gaze.
My God, if I didn't know better, I'd say you sounded like a goddamn orphan,
the scum of the Western world.
That's not fair, Niles,
Molly says, surprising everyone in the room, but especially Fraser.
She just told you she was afraid. We can all be forgiven that we're scared.
Sheba unexpectedly supports her,
hugging her knees in a chair at the periphery of the room.
"My dad is perfectly capable of killing us all," she says. "I caused all this. I can repair all the damage. I swear I can."
"First, we've got a job to do," Betty says. "We've got to deliver meals to these poor guys. They'll be waiting for us."
"I don't feel like moving a muscle," Sheba says. "I feel like staying in my bed, getting drunk, and watching old movies I've made. Maybe it'll help me forget that my old man, who I thought was dead, is a psycho axe murderer who knows my address."
Ike says, "Feed us good, Leo. Your fanciest shit. But we need to get all this stuff between us cleared up. Sheba, you get yourself ready, girl. Tonight, every one of us in this room is going to know the whole goddamn story from A to Z. You came into our lives like gangbusters about 20 years ago. None of us knows where you came from or why you showed up in the house across the street from Leo. We don't know anything about your mama except she was born to cause trouble. We've got to know everything. You can't hide anything from us because this guy has scared all of us before. Your daddy is Count Dracula and Cyclops and Frankenstein and Charles Manson to us, yet I don't think any of us would know him if he walked into this room. I don't know his name. I don't even know your daddy's name."
Sheba surprises us by saying, "I've told you." "Neither do I, Ike. Neither does Trevor."
"Tonight, Sheba Poe," Ike says, "you're coming clean. You're going to lay it all out for us. I don't mind dying for you. I really don't. But I'd sure as hell like to know why."
That night, Sheba takes center stage in her scrumptious bedroom, which stretches the length of the top floor. It has a sitting area made bright with an infestation of pillows and comfortable chairs, an overdone realm dedicated to comfort. All of the women look tiny on their observation perches, except Fraser, who sits tall next to Niles. Molly and I sit 10 yards apart, pretending we do not inhabit the same world.
"Trevor and I don't know where we were born or when," Sheba begins.
"You've got birth certificates?" Ike asks.
"Several," Sheba says. "On one, my name is Carolyn Abbott, and my twin brother is Charles Larson Abbott. The birthday remains the same. But we were born in St. Louis on the first birth certificate, and in San Antonio on the second."
"Your dad?" Ike asks.
"He changed his name and job every time we moved."
"Why on earth?" Molly asks.
"Don't have the foggiest. When you move every year, when you go from town to town, when everyone you meet is a stranger, you get confused about everything. When we lived in Cheyenne, Wyoming, Dad was called Dr. Bob Marchese. He spoke with an Italian accent and spent that year as a veterinarian whose specialty was beef cattle. In Pittsburgh, he called himself Pierre LaDavid and sold jaguars. In Stockton, California, he was an insurance salesman. I don't even know if my real name is Sheba Poe. Trevor once claimed he found 4 or 5 fake birth certificates and 3 passports for my dad, using 3 different surnames, none of them Poe."
"Didn't you ask your mother questions?" Fraser asks.
"Not many. If it was strange for us, it was a nightmare for her. When we got old enough to know better, we could tell she was scared of him. Of course, by then, we knew she had every reason to be."
Ike asks, "Did he beat her?"
"Not where it showed, but he could devise 1,000 ways to torture her. Sometimes he would torture her by not giving her any money for food. We'd always lived out in the country with no one around. No radio, no television, no neighbors, no cars. My dad was the only connection we had with the outside world." Fraser cries,
"Stop it. Stop it right now. None of this adds up. This isn't an American life you're describing to us. No one grows up this way. Where were your grandparents, your aunts and uncles? What did they say when they came to visit?
Grandparents? Aunts? Uncles? If I have them, Fraser darling, they haven't stepped forward.
Don't you think I've fantasized about that a million times? Don't you think I hoped that someone would see one of my films and say, "So that's what happened to Sheba"? But what if these mythical folks never heard of twins called Sheba and Trevor? What if they know us as Mary and Bill Roberts of Buffalo, New York? What if our mother just fell in love with our dad and said farewell to her family? There are a million scenarios, Fraser. And it's your tragedy that you only think there's one. That's not my tragedy, Fraser says. I have the luxury of knowing exactly who my family is and where they've lived for 300 years. Stability was the most important gift of my childhood. I'm giving that same gift to my kids.
You don't know where half of your children's family comes from, Niles reminds his wife. They're half mine. They've got hillbillies and moonshiners and mountain girls who didn't make it past the third grade in their backgrounds. Our kids have got as many ghosts in their family tree as Sheba and Trevor do. My mama stabbed someone, and so did my granny, and both her and my mama went to prison. That's one of the few things I know for sure.
That sad story has nothing to do with our children, Fraser insists.
It's got everything to do with our children, he says. It's the central story of their whole lives. They just don't know it yet.
I've protected them from everything about your history, Fraser says.
My history will find them, Niall says, because that's how history works.
That's how it worked for Starla, Fraser admits. But I've protected you from that past.
There's no such thing as protection from the past, I say. Ike puts up his hand to end this. The subject is Sheba. It's Trevor. It's her dad. It's her past we are trying to figure out now. We can talk about this other shit when we get back to Charleston.
The smiley face? Molly asks Sheba. I don't understand why that became the theme of your dad's presence, his evil. When I was a small girl, I loved smiley faces, Sheba shrugs. We had no money, so I would clip smiley faces out of newspapers and magazines. I found them everywhere for a while, on cups and paper plates, on ribbons and balloons. My dad didn't believe in hobbies, except for the piano. He was the one who taught Trevor and me to play. Otherwise, he had to be the center of our world. I came home from school one day, and he had painted a red tear on every smiley face I owned. He used my mother's fingernail polish. But by that time, everything was clear. My mother had already made plans to escape. Molly asks, what was clear? Sheba says, he'd already started in on me and Trevor, especially Trevor. I always thought he liked little boys better than girls, but he had a taste for both. Enough, Fraser cries. I can't even pretend I want to hear the rest of this, and I think I speak for all of us.
Silence can be measured out in shot glasses of time, or it can take up space in half-gallon bottles. This one lasts to the point of making Fraser feel both isolated and defensive. Her eyes glint as hard as those of a lioness that has caught the scent of hyenas moving toward her cub. Sheba's confession is unsettling to us all, but it is taking a horrific toll on Fraser's famous self-composure. In the elaborate collage that our friendship has patterned itself into over the years, Fraser has taken the high ground of normalcy. You could always depend on her to be both a solid citizen and a good egg, no matter how powerful the disturbances became in the airstreams around us. It is painful to watch her world turn to quicksand.
Niles, are you coming with me? Fraser asks. I've had enough. My imagination can provide the details.
I want this thing finished, Niles says, not unkindly. We all need to close this loophole in our lives, especially Sheba.
Sheba, there's no use in dragging us through every sordid detail of your dad's abuse of you and Trevor, Fraser protests. We get it already. We're in the middle of trying to live decent lives. We don't live in a world where kids get sexually abused by the adults in their lives. That's alien and disgusting, and I don't think it helps us find Trevor.
Niall says, in an orphanage, anything can happen to a kid, Fraser.
I was butt-fucked by 2 men before I was 10 and survived it. Me and Starla survived. That was the only thing.
Your sister didn't survive anything, Niles. Your sister is human wreckage, and we never know where she's going to wash up, Fraser spits out.
Niles and I know what an orphanage can do to a kid's spirit, Fraser, Betty says. We've made good lives for ourselves, but we have a long way to go.
Good night, everyone, Fraser says.
We hear her footsteps as they bound down the stairs with the athletic grace that remains her trademark. A door slams on the floor beneath us. Ike asks,
You okay, Sheba?
No, she answers. This is starting to make us hate one another, so I would rather stop. I'm sorry that my dad did that to me and Trevor, but these are the facts of my life. I didn't even know it was wrong when it was happening. Dad told me that girls and boys owed their father sex. It was how they paid for their upkeep. How are we to know different? Now I know it's sick, but I didn't know it when I was 5 or 6. Sheba.
Betty slides off the couch and kneels down next to a distraught Sheba, taking her hand.
Same thing happened to me.
My mother's boyfriend? He did me till social services moved in and got me out of there. I got to Charleston the same year as you and Trevor, same orphanage as Niles and Starla. We all helped save one another a little bit at a time.
I was lost so deep inside myself, I thought I'd never get out. Let's put an end to this, sweetheart. I ever get your old man in my gun sights, I'll send him over into the next world. So will Ike, Niles, and Toad.
Molly interrupts.
I feel the same, but I don't think I could kill him. I just don't think it's in me to kill anyone.
Sheba says,
Don't worry about it, Molly. I couldn't do it either. For the stupidest reason on earth, one that you will hate me for admitting.
You can tell us anything, Ike says. We're not capable of hating you.
Because he's my goddamn father. And here's how screwed up he's made me. I still love him because of that, and only that. He's my dad, and he's Trevor's dad. I'd love to see him disappear, but I don't want to see him die.
As she weeps, I observe Sheba and think that she has invented herself out of masks so numerous she can no longer select her own legitimate face out of the museum she has cultivated to hide herself in. Because she is an actress, she has fashioned an entire career out of identity theft. Sitting there, I find myself believing her completely, yet not really knowing if she has spoken the truth. It is difficult to trust a woman who has built herself out of a house of exits and not marked a single entrance.
What else do we need to know? Ike asks us as a group. We'll make this as fast as we can, Sheba. This has been terrible for you, for all of us.
Knowing your dad, why did you believe he was really dead, Sheba? Even with what was supposed to be his ashes,
Betty asks. Sheba shrugs.
That's what they told me in New York. They found his ID. I got the ashes.
When did this happen? Ike asks.
A few months ago, she says.
So how does he know you're out here? Niles says.
Herb Kahn told him Sheba's address, Molly says. Sheba's father was staking out Trevor's old apartment. Hell, Leo's written a bunch of columns about Trevor's apartment, too.
That's enough for tonight, Sheba, Ike says.
But there will be more. Why the obsession with you and Trevor? Molly asks. A simple game, one of absolute control, one that brooked no rebellion, Sheba says. My dad called himself master. He called us slaves. He said it was the simplest and most ancient and most honorable game on earth. And he once said, Here's my promise to you. It will never end. When he raped me in L.A., he confessed to me that he only had children because he wanted someone to fuck for the rest of his life. Having twins was a surprise, he told me. Double the pleasure, double the fun.
Chapter 17. New Denizen of the Washbag. On Friday, we began the difficult process of saying goodbye to the dying men we have been bringing lunch to for almost 2 weeks. The farewells are trying and emotional for all. Though Open Hand warned us about the dangers of growing too attached, the nature and seriousness of the duties have changed everything about us. We spend much of the day weeping as we make our departures. Already we have found 4 dead men in the hotels we serviced in the Tenderloin. That we have failed to locate Trevor weighs heavily, that sense of imminent failure causing despondency in most of us and surliness in Sheba. None of us has ever encountered such indomitable courage, relentless wit, and passion for life as we have since our lives intersected with these diseased, ravaged men. My soul feels tired as we head into the wash bag. The waitress, Leslie, greets us with a hug. Word has spread among the regulars that there still have been no sightings of Trevor.
I wasted everybody's time coming out here, Sheba says. I've put everybody's life in danger, and we still don't have jack shit to show for any of this.
She stops herself and collapses into tears. There is no acting here, only despair. And she begins whimpering like some small, soft, nocturnal creature. Before we can respond, Leslie comes running to our table from the front room, breathless.
Something odorous and homicidal this way comes, Leslie says.
What do you mean? Ike asks, rising out of his seat.
A huge black guy, obviously homeless, says he needs to talk to you guys.
Sheba has gained some control of herself, and it is she who first makes the connection.
That creep on the cable car? The one who tried to steal my purse?
I say to Leslie, make the biggest stake you've got with all the works. Bring it out to that first bench in the square. Niles and Ike are already on the street, talking to the only linebacker for the Oakland Raiders who lives in the back seat of a junkyard car.
Maybe he has news,
I say to the women following me as I reach the tense convocation taking place on Powell Street.
I ordered dinner for our man here, I tell Ike and Niles. They threatened to call the cops on me when I tried to go inside,
Macklin Tijuana Jones says, with true indignation.
You don't fit their client profile, Ike says in his most appeasing voice.
You promised $5,000 if anyone found your little faggot.
Macklin is sitting on a park bench as the rest of us stand.
Where's my money?
Ike says,
Where's our friend? The money doesn't change hands until we're shaking hands with Trevor Poe.
I found him,
Macklin says.
Like I said I would. I proved myself trustworthy. Now I want my money.
He takes out the flyer that we spread over the length and breadth of San Francisco and studies it as though it were a treasure map of infinite worth.
That's him, okay? I've seen him with my own eyeballs. Saw him yesterday.
Leslie comes into the park carrying a tray full of food and a 6-pack of beer. With some solemnity, she places the tray on Macklin's lap and says,
We fixed the steak medium rare. Is that okay with you, hon?
Just the way I like it, ma'am, he says. My compliments to the chef, and please add a 30% tip to my bill.
We watch as Macklin begins to eat dinner with surprising delicacy and enjoyment. Then I remember that he was once an NFL star and knew how to conduct himself in the best restaurants of any city.
Gentlemen, ladies, this is a fine, fine meal. You've seen Trevor Poe?
Ike demands impatiently.
With my own 2 peepers,
Macklin answers between bites.
Can you get us to him?
Ike asks.
Your boy's in trouble, lawman, he replies. Yeah, I can get you to him, but getting him out's going to be hell.
Where is he? Sheba cries.
Bunny's got him, Macklin replies. Who's Bunny? Ike asks. You don't even want to know, he says, concentrating on his food.
He points his fork at us.
Tell you what, meet me at 8 in the morning on Turk and Polk Street. You'll take us to see this Bunny? Ike asks. Hell no! Bunny'd kill me if he knew I was leading cops to his place. You afraid of somebody?
Ike asks.
That don't sound much like you. Bunny played for the Raiders a few years before I did,
Macklin says as he resumes eating.
Bunny Buncombe, were number 89. White boy who played for Florida State. He weighed 300 pounds then. Bet he weighs in at 400 now. He's mental. Bad crazy. Not cute crazy, but mean crazy. He'd kill his own mother and sell her used Kotex for a cough drop.
What a beautiful image, Fraser says.
Watch your language around my wife, Niles growls.
We came out to San Francisco for a vacation and a few laughs, I say. And we get to meet our friend Macklin again. Sheba's dad shows up for another go at the father-daughter dance. Now we find out Trevor's developed a friendship with a 400-pound wacko named Bunny.
Why would Trevor stay with someone like Bunny? Betty asks in bewilderment. He's always hated that kind of man.
You got it all wrong, ma'am, Macklin says. Your friend Trevor's a prisoner of war, like the rest of the pansies locked up in Bunny's house. He can't leave. Not allowed to.
He's an adult, Fraser says. He can leave if he wants to.
Hey, society lady, I've seen people go low in the Tenderloin. Hell, I've been low in the Tenderloin. But Bunny has built his own kind of hell there. It may be worse than hell. I'll have to die to find out, won't I? Anyway, he says, finishing his meal and laying his napkin on the tray. I'll meet you nice folks at 8 in the morning, and we'll see what we can do. There's a coffee shop run by Mr. Joe on the east side of Polk near Golden Gate. Meet me there. How do we know you'll be there? Ike asks. 5,000 reasons. You come ready to rumble. Bunny will kill every one of you if you try to interfere with his little lifestyle. By the way, your particular faggot ain't doing so good. And I'll bet one of you is going to get killed by Bunny.